argues through basically a little bit of the history of the experiment. Of course, emphasis would be on the run we've done last year, before and after the well-known LHC performances. So I'll go a little bit through the concept of the beginning, how installation has gone through the past 3 years. Now I'll concentrate on the September 2008 scenario and also some words about what we've done after the discussion. And then probably the process will be a lot of discussion, which had started right over lunch. Okay, so the concept. So the story is long. There are legends about how people getting up in the pub, in the village next to the lab, started conceiving this. Anyways, formally speaking, the first document actually put in at CERN management was in 1993, so we can take that as a reference number of when the experiment started. Several steps afterwards, many years have gone. I hope I'll try to convince you that, given the technological challenges and development that have taken us having working facilities, I'll try to give you a reason why it's taken so long. Okay, so there is a sort of constitution of the experiment, scientifically speaking. So there are basically 4.5 rooms. Yeah? Actually, let's first look at it. So when the design was finalized, actually some physics channel would use as a benchmark. Now, this is a very old slide, which I took from our spokesperson. And I think it dates back 92. So the standard model Higgs was used at the time as a benchmark in the channel, so that the detector design would be driven by it. So you can see two sort of regimes. This parameterizing Higgs mass, so that basically the experiment had to have sensitivity to this mass spec. So you have the low energy region where you want to be sensitive to the gamma decay. And this drives the calorimetric requirements because the width of the Higgs is extremely minute, so you want to have the best calorimeter possible to keep the reconstructed width small. And then, as long as the ZZ star coming as a detector as possible decays, you also want to have excellent capability of reconstructing charged electrons. Electrons, again, that require good tracking and excellent calorimetry, and muons that require good tracking and that, of course, benefit from strong magnetic fields. So these are basically the constitutional rules. You want to have very good muon identification and momentum measurement because that's basically a stronger, cleaner way of reconstructing the Higgs in the higher mass region and all sorts of signatures. But if you keep that as a signature, secondly, as I said, you want to have very high energy resolution for electromagnetic calorimeter so that you know I'm particularly affectionate to this because I actually mostly have so far worked on the electromagnetic crystal calorimeter of the experiment. You want to have a powerful inner tracking system, significantly better than that. And you want to have good hermeticity so that you have good capability of reconstructing jets and missing energy, which is a crucial variable for all sorts of systems. Last not least, it has to be affordable, right? We have to actually, we have to have a budget for this. So this is long time ago. All right, so if we look a little bit at what the, when you design an experiment, you also have to understand what sort of physics you produce by your accelerator. The LHC, from the point of view of a physicist, kinetic experimentalist, is a big beast. He's a tough guy to be working on. So, in fact, the LHC detectors, in particular ATLAS and CMS, I won't be talking about ATLAS today, but these two are the twin experiments located diametrically opposite positions around Ring. And although through different, radically different technological solutions, they both try to, what you say, be omnipurpose, namely, be able to capture all or many of the signatures that we expect. For the high energy unexplored regime that LHC would encompass. So when you design an experiment, you have to make sure that you are suitable and you are performant at the machine, at the environment that the machine will give you. So LHC is a proton-proton machine. Along the 27 kilometers of ring, you have 2,800 bunches of particles. You have a long train in a direction colliding against the corresponding train on the other direction. The spacing, this is something you want to maybe take home to play one of the things. The spacing between two consecutive bunches is 8 meters. Now, if you turn it in time, it means that you have a crossing, it means that you have 40 megahertz of bunch crossing in the middle of your experiment. This is a lot of data. Of course, there's no way you can possibly record this. Both experiments have about 1 megabyte of event size. So anytime you decide to trigger and take this event, it's 1 megabyte. So you understand that this is an inconceivable number. This is something that you really want to go down to. So you have to be smart, and out of the 40 million per second bunch cross, you want to keep the good ones.
Can I have a very limited question?
So
how do you accelerate the protons?
So along the rings, you have actually one point only. I will come to this a little later. But okay. So along the ring, you have one point where you have radio frequency carriers. So once you have injected the beam at 450 GeV, coming from the SPS, which is the earlier accelerator in the LHC chain, you go from 450 GeV to, let's say, 70 eV, just by ultimately by electric field. So you synchronize the particles going through to this oscillating field in this cavity, such that at every passage, this particle gets kicked forward.
And the confusion is that, you know, they have the same charge and they're going in the opposite direction, right?
So yeah, but as you see in this cartoon, the two beams, there are two pipes. This is not a plus minus machine. There are two pipes. And in fact, I'll show you later on a cross section of the magnets. Other than in the interaction regions, the two trains travel in separate bodies, of course. So not only do you have 40 megahertz bunch crossing per second, but also you do not have only one interaction per bunch crossing, right? Because you have 10 to the 10 particles, 10 to the 10 particles. On average, you have about 20 proton-proton interaction at every cross. So you understand that your detector has quite a hard time, because indeed you have about 1 gigahertz of interaction. Now, we could make a seminar just on how you do this job of going from 1 gigahertz to 100 hertz, but I won't do it today. Anyway, it's a lot of challenges, in particular on the trigger system.
So, but this is the same as NEP, as LEP, more or less?
Absolutely not. Technology. Absolutely not. LEP has had much fewer packets. And in particular, the cross section for the plasma mounting is so incredibly smaller, so that actually LEP, when you look at the interaction, it goes about 1 hertz. So in this respect, the LEP technology is stone age. In this respect, I mean, the LEP experiments were fantastic at first. So don't misunderstand me. But from the point of view of how big is the haystack you are looking into, which you're looking for your tiny needle, LEP was a piece of cake. For fundamentalism, for physics reasons.
The big thing about E plus and minus is that you don't have QCD background.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. The cross section is minute, the total cross section.
You see CC bar, bang, very sharp thing.
Yeah.
You can't do that with computer.
Yeah.
So, broadly speaking, you choose those 100 events to discover the Higgs. I mean,
you choose those 100 events to do the entire physics problem. Those 100 events are, in fact, from an empirical point of view, those 100 events are the only ones we will ever get to do analysis.
So the Higgs and Suzier
are in there.
Basically.
And it's the smartness of this talk that I want to do today, of making sure that you are as efficient as you can possibly be for the interesting signatures. Now, obviously, going from 40 megahertz to about 100 kilohertz is trivial. Because many of these 40 megahertz of bunch crossing generate soft QCD stuff that you can very easily reject. How to go from 100 kilohertz about to 100 hertz, that is the subtle stuff, such that you have to do a fairly elaborate reconstruction of your event already at this very high rate to make sure that you don't miss out any of the interesting signatures. So,
and
that level one trigger is not adjustable.
It is absolutely adjustable.
Is it? I thought it was the hardwired stuff.
No, I mean, the hardwired means that you don't have computers performing this 40 megahertz to 100 kilohertz selection. You have dedicated boards, but they are programmable. And the typically what you do in real life is you have manifolds, what we call paths. So you have matching groups of criteria that pick up these on that signature, you know, one for one electromagnetic cluster, one jet, two jets, three jets, 1 million, 2 million, and so on. And typically, what you do is change some key cuts in these selections. But you can definitely do. I mean, imagine the selections we will put in place October this year will be very much different than the ones we will have once the machine will be at full performance. So you absolutely need flexibility. Also, as you go on up, not only that, but once you are in, let's say, a given LHC running mode, measurements might tell you that you want to do something otherwise. If physics shows up here, you chase it, and you have the tools to do that.
I thought those were higher level triggers that you could adjust.
Both.
You're saying the level one, lowest level trigger is adjustable.
Sure. I mean, listen, the level one comes first. So if the level one doesn't serve you, there's nothing you can do at the higher level. Of course, you have to keep the balance between the two. I mean, there are also other. So this is the physics reason why you have a level one adjustable trigger as well as high level trigger adjustable. There are also practical reasons. Like if one of the cells of your detector goes crazy, your trigger would be completely fooled by it because you would always reconstruct, you know, a big jet in this hot cell. So you want to make sure that you have the flexibility to turn it down. So you have two fundamental reasons why you want to have that flexibility, and we do. Okay, so as a consequence of these very interesting numbers, also keep in mind that when you have a high frequency of interactions, and each interaction carries several tracks, look at this example. This is a Higgs event. Look at the four new ones. One, two, three, four from the but look at the amount of junk which comes in.
What are the muons?
Yeah, they are the. You see that they don't bend because it has hyperty.
I see.
It has hyperty. So all this stuff is soft stuff. So you see it bends around in the 3.8 Tesla.
For velocity.
And more momentum. So when you want to be able to make sense out of this, you need to have a very high granularity. Because otherwise, if the chance that there's two tracks in a given event is high that they end up in the same cell, broadly speaking, you are lost. So when you see, this basically explains the fact that our inner trapping system, which is the region because of the magnetic field where the low underlying events, you know, populates a lot. So this has driven the fact that our inner silicon tracking system has about 100 million channels. I can't think. Okay, so this figure you may want to memorize a little bit. It will drive our trip later on. So the like most or all, I would say, experience, the collider, also CMS has an onion-like structure where you have systems specialized in detection of certain particles. I will go through that quickly. Electromagnetic calorimeter, I spoke about this earlier. In this figure, you understand this is CMS opened up, right? So this is a coil. So the current flows like this. The 3.8 Tesla field goes like this and is sucked up in a yoke to go back. So the field goes like this. This is the situation where the experiment is basically now open. You see that it's longitudinally segmented. You have some barrel wheels and some end cap regions. So the beam line goes along this, goes in here. So you see the little man? It's 12 meters tall and 20 meters long. We have to give credit to Atlas. They are bigger. They are, in fact, four times in volume and half the mass. So CMS wouldn't float, that's for sure. Atlas would float if you found a big enough bag to put in. This is one of the obvious benchmarking numbers that the technology has completed between the two. So going through the layers, so the electromagnetic calorimeter is this part. It's made of scintillating crystals, very dense. The density is about 9, so you pick up a thing like this, which is 10 kilograms. Okay, I will come on to this one anyway. This is where the gamma-gamma fan have to spend their hopes and their trust.
That's why you guys spent so much money on the crystal, right?
Yes, sir. I know something about that.
Well,
the story of this crystal production is a very, very long story. It will also be very long, but we need it for discussion. I don't want to go too much into it.
What percentage of your budget went to the crystals?
To the purchase of the crystals? The numerator is easy. I think it was 60 million. The denominator is complicated. Anyway,
yeah.
Around 10%, but the numerator is very complicated. I can tell you half a billion as a reference number, but okay, depending on how you do the budget, a European or American. Anyways, let's say 10% plus. So hadronic calorimeter. So this is the hadronic calorimeter. It's a sampling calorimeter, other than the earlier one, which is a homogeneous. The EGAL is crystals read out here. So the showers have to be contained in there and you read out light from scintillation. The H-cal, the hadronic calorimeter, is slightly different. The calorimeter is so-called sampling calorimeter. So you have layers of brass where the particles are expected to start showering and propagate. So basically, that's where you make the hadronic showers. And scintillators, intervals that pick up part of the energy. You sum all the scintillators together to get an estimate of the release energy. Tracking. So, as I said earlier, the tracking part is this one. You see that it's segmented in two parts. So, the silicon mixer part is this innermost part. The technology is not dissimilar from what we have inside our digital cameras, although here the radiation levels are huge. So, of course, don't buy it off the shelf. This also has taken a long time of R&D. So the pixel has 66 million channels. And the strips, which although they have fewer channels, they cover a much bigger space, about 10 million channels. These are two completely different technologies, although all silicon based. So this is how you do electrons for low energy, because at high energy the bending is too small. So the calorimetric estimate of the electron energy is more important. And in particular, is how you do the movement. So I'm trying to sort of go through this not just as a shopping list, but let's keep in mind the physics case, right? And the what I call the constitution.
So this is just to exclude the lowest energy events.
Not really to exclude. So you want to accumulate a number enough of points of detected points along each charged particle that go through your inner tracking volume. Yeah. So it's a 1.3 meters radius thing, about 6 meters long. So in there, you want to recollect as many points so that you fit a helix, because you are bending in magnetic field, as you possibly can. Now, with these two guys, you do 11 to 13 points, of which the first three are very high precision, very close to the impact. The remaining one are from 30 centimeters to. You don't want to reject, you want to master your event. I like to see it more the other way, more than rejecting what you don't like. You want to characterize very well the high PT electrons or muons, or pions. Although for the pions, the hadronic calorimeter is what gives the most contribution. Okay, so the end of the name of the experiment comes from my mess. It is an incredible piece of technology, 6 times 13 meters, 3.8 Tesla, the operation field, 1.6 gigajoule of stored energy. It is impressive, I must say. When you look at it, you understand how big it is, really. It is impressive. Probably this picture doesn't make it justice to it. Okay, last not least, the S. Sorry, no, the M of the name comes from the neural system. It is all located outside the magnet, intervening the return ion node, so that you use your magnetic field twice, right? The 3.8 Tesla you use inside the yoke, and then you suck it back in, you conserve flux, so the magnetic field is about half, right? So that then you can place a million detectors in there. They are all charging detectors. They are all gas detectors. And you see that you have triplets, drift tubes, cathode seed chambers, and resistive PET chambers. They provide redundancy and complementarity. So the RPCs are very fast. They have a very fast response. So they are mostly used to measure how at what time a particle has gone through. And this this contributes to the proper branch crossing assignment. The drift tubes and the CSCs are good tracking detectors. So that's where you do your momentum track, your PT of the moon. Okay, some sociology very quickly. We are about 2,500 people. US and Italy are the two largest communities. Many are the Russian, Serbian, and France. Many, many small contributions from non-member states in the country of the world.
Can I ask a question?
Sure.
This is probably silly, but you published a paper announcing the discovery of the Higgs. How are you going to put all these names on the paper?
Standing the current rules. To be more precise, to be on the author list, you have to fulfill duties, which means you have to.
So there's a hierarchy.
No, there is a cut. If you have done the right amount of shift and service work, you are in this list. If you have not, you are not in this list. Although you are a member of the expert. I think that once we will start publishing routinely physics measurements, not detector papers, this discussion will be reignited. Other experiments have found other solutions. Like, for instance, basically 80 to 85 subgroups of people that have contributed specifically to this or that paper. Like Babar, for instance, has a very interesting schema on how basically you propose yourself for a paper. And this basically reduces the number of authors and makes the list more telling, if you want. Anyway, this is a big problem also for Archer 8, right? Because just by having your 300 publications with 2,300 names doesn't really tell much about you, right? Of course, there are other complementary things which are important, like, for instance, the internal loss of the detector is likely to be playing is going up. So although they are not published papers, the nodes internal to the experiment that you have published only carry a few names. So those are sort of starting to be considered as indication of what you have actually done. Okay, so I'll quickly browse through. There is a plan. That is how we want the experiment to be. So how does it work to actually make it? So I'll go quick. So where are we? So I guess most of you have been at CERN or at least seen this before. So this is Geneva. This is where you land. This is the airport. This is CERN, namely the main land site, the main field site. This is the LHC. Now pick the most distant point and the most annoying point that you can reach by driving 20 minutes every time you have to go. That's the answer. The Atlas guys are here, so they can even go to the CERN company for lunch. Anyways, here you have Alice, the heavy ion collision experiment. Here you have Alice. And here is my heart, but that's much faster. So if you zoom like in here, this is how the site looked like in 2000. I picked this picture because it's interesting and it shows you the hole. So what is this hole? So CMS is mechanically interesting, although that's not why we make it, but basically choice was made by our fathers such that most of the experiments would actually be put together on the ground. It's typically, when you have an underground machine, you make a hole, fitting your experiment, and you assemble it there. So for many years, we've had a surface and underground sort of battlefields. At the beginning, the underground was just the cranes and in the civil engineering. The reason for this is it's somewhat costly, but it allows you a lot of flexibility because underground sites have all sorts of restrictions. You cannot have more than this many number of people. You have to refurbish the air conditioning and whatnot. And also safety. Safety is much looser on a surface installation. So this is our fathers thought of this. We benefited of this a lot in the last 3 years when we were close and we had to put things together. So Atlas was ready as many as before. We benefited much by having this. So a little bit more of the screenshot. So this is a later image of the lake upstairs. This is daylight. So this is how the cavern looked in 2006. Beautiful, white, with a nice logo, empty. Because all the work was going on upstairs. Interesting feature, whenever you go to CERN, whenever I do guided tours, I'll ask the people, do you know what these red little things on top are? But here you see what they really are for. So the fire safety system has been developed so that you can fill in a few minutes, like 12 minutes or something like this, like half of the cavern with foam. So why not using water? Because supposedly, if you dump water on the experiment, you throw it away. So fire equals finished. Small fire, setting of the alarm equals finished. Now, supposedly these foams are used in like electronics professional environment, and supposedly you can wash your electronics off and it should work again afterwards. Now, I don't think we really want to try that. But at least one thing was tested before the experiment was in there. So this was fun. Okay, 206. So this is yet in surface. You see that there is some action here. If you compare this picture to this picture, what's the action? Well, start going. Look, the neon, you see that these silver chambers have made it in. You might recognize the brass color of the hadron collimator. You might recognize two little guys of the electromagnetic collimator. So the goal was in 2006 that we should test the magnet out. But then we liked the game. So we did about a month of data taking. So basically you would collect cosmic rays and you'll hear more about this. So you would trigger a cosmic ray with the detector that is meant to be triggering on the muons, the muon chambers. And you would read out basically a little portion of everybody else. So two atomic collimator opposite sector, a little piece of H-cloud, there was a little piece of the tracker in there. We never thought we would even be able to write a paper on this. The goal was test everything out for the first time, be able to read out data from all the subsystems, which is a complicated business, be able to trigger on the neurons. In the end, things worked out quite well. It was a lot of effort, 4 months of effort. In the end, we were even able, with this although small part of the neuron system, we were even able to do the neon cosmic charge symmetry. It was also very much team building experience. Because 2,200 people tend to operate everybody in their own corner, which is the first time when really we sort of start to act as a collaboration. Okay, I'll go fairly quick. So at some point we started lowering. There was just before Christmas 2006. One of the forward Hadron collimator went down. This is actually the last piece which was lowered about over a year later. So it was one of the only caps. Consider that the lowering these pieces is per se a technological interesting job. There's only two companies in the world that went for the standard. In the end, a Swiss company took it. Consider it takes 11 hours because you have to do it very slow. And consider that most of these pieces, the central one, it's 2,500 tons. Most of these pieces, we do not have technology to bring them up. Of course, you can take them to smaller pieces and do it. But anyway, at this moment, we cannot bring CMS references unless we take small sizes. Okay, so does this look like a mess? Thank God it's not a mess, but it's a cabling the experiment up has been a year of work for very many people. It's mostly done by high people, so the physicists only get to like do the checks and are very, very strongly supported by external people, which is probably also very good because the average physicist is probably somebody you want to get to the job. 250 kilometers of cable just to make an end. So just for you to understand, this is the solenoid. Yeah? So inside here you have the carolinas and tractor. The experiment is open now. Okay, so let's come to the meat, to the further meat. CMS with beams. So the whole business started the first week of September. There is something that we are not supposed to say, but in fact, beams were in the accelerator before the test. So we had to call them synchronization tests because of agreement with the press and whatnot. But anyway, so what happens is you have beam one, which goes, it's called beam one, which goes this way. And B2 is this is the so September 7 or 8, it was a Saturday. So what happens is you have the SPS going since, and you started injecting one beam up to here. Actually up to here, 2 kilometers the first one. So basically this means that the LHC had to have the optics ready, the magnets up and the B field ready to accept these 450 GeV particles and drive them through 2 kilometers of pipe without losing them, without smashing against any of the walls of it, of the magnets. Of course, they went in steps, right? So already on the 8th, if I remember right, we have been able to bring a beam up to CMS, in particular up to 150 meters before the CMS interaction point, dump it on a collimator, so make a big jam out of this, and then let CMS play with the challenge of detecting this event. So it actually worked. I will come to this more later because this what we call the splash events. So LHC packet into collimator dump, so you have a whole lot of hadronic production, and then you get a shower of moons. You will hear more about this. September 10th.
Sorry. So usually we wouldn't expect to see anything. The two beams collide, right? So
you will see more later.
You should just go through your CMS.
Three level, yes. In reality, the machine has always a small level of loss. So what you call beam hail. You will see this.
Okay.
But you never dump a normal operating procedure. You have no interest in dumping one packet on the collimator. You dump it on the beam dump when you kill them. But this was done basically for the benefit of the experiment. And you see how much we learned from these 23 events. Because we actually managed to detect them. So September 10th, that's when BBC and many other journalists, the CERN parking lot was full of these dishes, and it was quite strange, I must say. It was a strange day driving into us. So it took this, I must say, amazing beam guys about an hour to take beam one all the way. All the way, it never happened. They had only gone half the way. It was very exciting. I must say it was a very special day, especially for people that, not like me, have been in this business for 6 years, but people have been for 50. And it took them an hour to do the same thing at LEP. It took them 15 hours. So, and LEP was even a simpler machine. So, okay, beam one was done. We went for lunch. Beam two. It took also not very long. By before coffee break for afternoon, beam two has also gone around. And then they started playing, and they even let the beam go up to about 300 turns. So the game starts to become serious. Not only that, but consider these are particles that travel inside the accelerator, only bent by the magnetic field, but not accelerated in any way. So as you teach me, the synchrotron radiation, which is so important in a plasma machine, and the electron slowdown. Since the proton has so much bigger mass, the gamma factor is not any close to one of the electrons. So basically, these particles just go around, and you can keep them for up to a few hundred turns. up, and that's when the momentum starts to go down, so you will have to accelerate them. So this is what happened. And look at this, it's one day later. So on September 11th, special day, this was for other reason, beam one was what we say, RF capture. I'll come to this more later. From our perspective, we did good in this, I must say. I think both experiments did great. Basically, we were able to trigger and detect the first event. And this is also a very unusual configuration for astronauts. So I think that a little bit more details along the beam. So this is, push it up here, next try again. So these are, this is the propagation line of the beam. These are basically electric elements that pick up induction signal. This is the beam that has gone through twice. This is, I can't see the scale now, I think it's 20 millimeters. So you see that the beam actually is quite wide. And this is the story on the longitudinal axis. So at each of these points, they pick up the deviation in horizontal and vertical. So you this is the ideal place, the beam jiggles around a little bit and you are able to detect it. So you see that it's in the range of 2 millimeters. So that, they make it through, but they are learning, right? They are learning how to keep the beam into axis. Okay, here's what Google dedicated us. My students in the end are one of the main internet
speakers. Sorry, back on the last slide, how actually narrow would you want would be ideal or what's aimed for?
300 microns. I mean, these guys are learning, but they do it well. I mean, 300 microns, 10 millimeters. So,
but learning means that in each.
In each of these points, you have a beam monitoring device telling you where the beam is. So, what you do is the magnets for this, you click a little bit, this one is the other way around. So, that's what you do on day one because it had never happened before. So, you have some design parameters for the currents that you flow on every dipole, but this is the starting point. Okay, so this is our spokesperson, GPD, technical coordinator, design components. Okay, there was also a lot of work going on. Don't just think we were, somebody was really working in there, trying to figure out these events. Okay, so how did the CMS react to these first circulating beams? So we have a certain number of tools. So here is the experiment. So inside the experiment, you have two beam radiation, beam condition monitors. Basically, they are there to detect how much radiation the pixel gets. So it's never really going to be used for physics, but it's used for this kind of low level. Not only that, but about 150 meters upstream. You have two beam pickup time detectors. You just pick up a signal induced by the traveling charge. So basically, this is a time projection. So the beam, BPDX, called beam pickup time X of beam one, notice they are separated. So a signal. Now this is off phase, but then look at the two detectors which are inside the detector, they are about 5 or 6 meters apart. There you go, you see the signal. And if you look at this, the distance you are measuring the speed of, it's about 15 nanoseconds, and which boils down to the length of the object. So you start off, really you start off with a scope. The first time you synchronize your detector to the machine. A few more words about the splashes. So I told you basically what you do is you bring the packet. You change the optics such that you dump on a collimator. So 10 to the 5, 10 to the 10 protons shower in this material with a certain opening. CMS is about 150 meters laser. Basically, only muons make it through, but they muons. So the achievement here is you have been able to have this object synchronized to your experiment such that from a trigger signal coming from this, you are able to read the data at the right time. So this is what you see. Now, this is blue, it's the energy deposited in the hadronic collimator. This is Z and R. and this is the cross section, and this is the energy deposited in the electromagnetic array. Now, you see the number of cells which fly up is humongous. Basically, every cell, every crystal lit up. Also, you see that there is a certain asymmetry. If you look at what the tunnel is like, and there is, the tunnel is actually not, of course, it's not round. It's as a round bubble, but then have a floor. So this is basically what it is. Most of the particles travel through, but they do not, they get further suppressed in the lower part, because just there's more material. So this is more details of the electromagnetic calorimeters, which has a barrel region and two end caps. This is. So 99% of the cells fired up. This is something that we're not going to see in physics, although the events are very popular. In each of these events, you have about 200 TeV of the release energy. And it is just humongous.
So it means that those gamma rays are those energy.
So this energy is released by muons going through. So a muon releases energy in two ways, by continuous energy loss or by Bremsstrahl in the material. Most likely, the largest fraction of this energy is actually Bremsstrahl. So you have a 100, 200 GeV muon making it through, releasing a little bit, and then putting out a photon. So that's what you see here. And then each of these photons makes a little charge. So you know, every photon gives you energy in a volume like this. But when you have a humongous amount of muons, you basically cover your advanced system. And you basically have a wall of muons coming up. You have like a plane wave of muon, and we, the ones which go through your calorimeters, release, you know, go undergo Bremsstrahl, which means a lot of energy. Okay, then we, of course, you want to convince yourself of what's going on, and then what you're seeing is also you start correlating parts of the system to each other. And it made incredible sense. This plot was made like the evening of the splashes, so immediately, no tricks of any kind. So around the region where you have damped the beam, there is all sorts of the detectors for the machine people to pick up the loss of it. And CMS has calorimeters. And when you try and correlate the accelerator monitoring device's energy to the ECAM, you see that there is a certain level of correlation. Now, there are different SAS devices, so the correlation you pick up is slightly different in that case. Also, if you try and correlate the two calorimeters to each other, so the electromagnetic and hadronic, you also get actually an amazing linear thing. Because these two calorimeters are, of course, much more precise than these objects. As you can see, this is the ratio of the deposited energy, H cal over the cal. So H cal is about 6.5 times more energy. Now, what is the reason? The reason is that E cal has 22 centimeters deep crystals. H cal has 1.3 meters. So the volume of muons you are collecting is so much bigger. These splash events, from a detector perspective, were extremely important and extremely useful. Although I have to be completely honest, the idea of running these splash events came only a few weeks later. It's not something we ever really counted on. Why is it important? Because initial thing you have to do with any high energy detector, you have to make sure that each of its subcomponents are well timed in. So you want to make sure that the signal you read out from subdetector A and subdetector B correspond to the same lab. There's no phase, because this would completely wash away the picture. So here you have this wall of traveling muons. It's a perfect time reference, because you have like a running watch on the z-axis. So this is the basic z-axis. It's super rapidity, but you can read as the z-axis of the cells of the electromagnetic current, which is cut sketched here. It makes little end caps here. So you have the muons that come along this. So the time changes as they go on. Now, why don't you see a line? Well, because the way you have a pre-safety odds detector is for collisions. At this stage, we were expecting collisions in a week. So when you operate your detector at collision, the particles all come out at once. So they travel different time to your detector. So what you do is you counterbalance this time of flight issue fact with the fact that you read out this part of your system slightly earlier than this one, so that for a given event, you read out everywhere at the optimal time. So the settings are like a spheric wave of time, like, you know. But these guys came along. If you run some trigonometry with the collision settings and the wall of moons, you expect the blue curve. The red points are what you measure. This was very cool that we got this right. If there's time and if you're interested, I can explain what modulations. We understand that. So basically, anyway, bottom line is, this is nanoseconds. You see that you are mastering your time, let's say to the nanosecond, 1.5 nanosecond level, which is pretty amazing. Considering that, you do this based on basically laboratory measurement alone. You have never done a collision before. Okay, this is for HCAL, analogous exercise, slightly more complicated for your questions. Okay, then Philip was saying, what happens when the beam is gone? So let's see if this works. So this is a run. You start off with cosmic rays. You see this track. This is real reconstructed data. You start off with cosmic rays that come from all over the place. And you see that this is the beam axis. The direction is randomized. The cosmic rays, they come down. Then the machine goes up. You see that the tracks that you reconstruct start to be so much more biased towards the beam axis direction. And basically what you're picking up here is the fact that although keeping the beam along the orbit, there is a certain level of loss, which in particular before the beam is RF capture is big. So, you know, this is fairly convincing way of telling your accelerator machine, yes guys, we see the beam. Then at some point you can see that the beam goes off. This run I think lasted about 9 minutes. At 9 minutes, this was second day of operation, 9 minutes of running. And then you see that at some point the run goes off and you go back to the earlier state when you have this impact. Less frequent and random direction, so the random direction can be fast. So looking into this a little bit, of course the neon detectors play a fantastic role. They were like the star of the day, right? Because this is what they do, right? Exactly, you reconstruct these tracks. So I'm just flashing through some event displays. So that sort of gives you a feeling. And again, keep in mind that you want to make sure that what you see is real, you cross-check sub-detector with each other. Yeah? So you can see this here, this is the neon detector. The two colors are horizontal and vertical cables. This is the other color in here. So you see that there is a line which matches fits basically the points here and the points here, and there is energy between the color. So that's convincing. And another one, this is basically, similar to before, cathode strip chambers, picking up a truck. Yet another coincidence. These are cathode strip chambers, one of the three neons of the detector, and this is the drift loop. So, here are cross correlating two drift loop systems together. This was a great event because this is a Halo event, beam Halo event, where you actually have multiple tracks. So, you have three independent tracks, so probably somewhere upstream. A beam gas interaction of some kind or something gave you three neons in this event. Okay, so a little bit more insight into this. This is a plot of an angle. So zero means if you take the plane vertical to the beam, you consider the normal to this plane. So zero means you are traveling along the normal to the basically you are parallel to the beam. Now cosmic rays is the black curve. You see that you have on average a bigger than zero angle, points around 0.35. From simulation of email, the blue curve is what you expect in state when you run your system on the email. The red is what we actually experienced. Now, to be honest, the blue and the black curve have been pre-normalized. I mean, because of course the relative abundance of cosmic versus halo is unpredictable. But you see that this is the run, basically what I showed you before. You have a mixture, an melange of some cosmic ray coming in around the time in the beam. I told you before about RF capture. What does this mean? At some point, at the beginning of the second day, the accelerator people have been able to synchronize the particles circulating to the RF cavities that, with magnetic field, accelerate the same particles. Right? This is a very important step, because once you've done this, you are able to compensate for the momentum loss of your particles, and you are basically able to keep up your beam indefinitely, supposedly. Not only that, but when you are able to re-give energies to your particles, you're also able to control the beam much better. So look at this. Hadronic calorimeter, this is an event or a collection of events when the beam was circulating just out of inertia, let's say. This is the same detector when the beam has been captured. So you see that the beam becomes much cleaner. So basically they are on the way to shrinking down all those deviations and also compensating for energy. So these are starting to become very long. The one you seen before lasted 9 minutes. Same story in the new detector. You see that if you count how many hits you have per second, this is time, this is the CSC, this one that was going before, you have a certain rate. And then back, when they lock the beam to the RF, so they start accelerating, you see that it goes dramatically. Not only that, but to be completely honest, we actually had collisions. Now, non-beam-beam collisions. So the collisions we had was traveling protons and gas. Now, the beam pipe is a 27-kilometer tube, right, that you have, of course, emptied, made a vacuum. But it takes quite a long time for the tube to yet release the gases which are trapped in the surface layers of the tube, of the internal surface layers of the tube itself. So you still have a certain level of gas present in the beam. But when a proton hits into one of these gas, it basically does a... unfortunately, you're not in the correct reference frame, but it actually does a proton to nucleus. So how do you actually observe this? So this is your calorimeter, z-axis, yeah? So minus side, plus side, and this is across sinus. And if you look at the energy that gets released in your system, you see that there is a bias. So as you accumulate many ones, you see that you tend to pick up more energies in the direction where the beam travels. So here actually, the reason is that the fraction of the cube near to the experiment has been closed at last. So it's the dirtiest region. Therefore, there's more chances that the collisions develop near it, and therefore there is this asymmetry. Okay, so I think I've told you more or less all about this. Except, I told you all about this, right? Both being injected, beam splashes when you have this huge amount of muons, both means circulating for hundreds of turns, RF locking more than 2 minutes of circulation. So, to take the machine at 10 TeV, you need to try out before every single dipole and put into it the current which develops the field, which is corresponding to 5.5 TeV. There are LHCs organized in 8 sectors, 7 have been tested and passed the test. So you have put 9.3 kiloamperes, keep this number in mind, 9.3 kiloamps on every single bloody one, 7 out of 8, on 7 eights, everything worked fine. So one night when I was in the control room, a power converter break, something which provides power to the klystrons, accelerating the particles. It took a few days to replace. CMS brought it. It took a couple of days or 3 to replace. So decision was made, okay, let's make up time. Let's test the 8th sector, the one which have not tested yet, for 5 TV before. The original plan was, we have 7 tested, we do 900 GV collisions, SPS energy, we commission the last one after, and then we go to 10 TV. Let's make up time, no? It sounds like a sensible plan.
This was politically directed, right?
Eh?
This was a political decision?
No, I mean, this is a, you don't waste your time. I mean, we never thought that this splicing could generate problems. So you act based on the knowledge you have, on the 2 years of on-surface testing of every single dipole. So you say, the experiments were there saying a part of the experiments said we want to go to 10 TV as soon as possible. Because don't forget that in the scenario of last year, we would have run only for 2 months. The cross-section between 900 GV and 10 TV are hugely different. So you want, the experimentalist wants to waste the least amount of time possible on 900 GV. And we honestly had no prejudice that after having tested 7/8 of the magnet, the trouble would be sitting on the last one. So 11.
That last sector that
had been tested up. It had been tested, everything had been tested on the surface.
Okay, so everything was on the same footing until this final test.
Yes.
Okay, because I heard somehow that one sector that was being left to the last sector was left for last for a reason, that there was some degree of less.
No, there were
preparation work or testing
some steps were skipped, but nothing that had to do with the failure.
But just for this sector?
Just for two sectors. I'm not sure which other one there is. So, September 19th, quite an unfortunate day. What happened? Well, I go quick, I think you heard about this. Basically, two neighboring dipoles are connected by this superconducting, which allows the current to go through one and then the next. A resistance developed in one of them, and notice, on 600 amps away, so the development of heat and therefore loss of superconductivity developed at 8.7 kiloamps, and we were aiming for 9.3. Ready? Basically, this basically broke apart, punctured the helium container of two neighboring crystals, degenerated a wave which propagated. It was properly handled by those two, but not by the next ones. So it was actually a little bit of a mess. So this is how beautiful the object looked like. This is how the most displaced dipoles look like. So there was some mechanical action going on there. So how much time do I have left? This is probably an hour.
Yeah.
Should I?
Perhaps we can conclude.
Yeah,
and,
I don't have anything. So I had a whole section about cosmic rays.
The outlook would be good to hear.
What's that?
The outlook would be good to hear.
Sure.
May I ask a question?
Sure. I can skip the cosmic. Yeah.
Sure. It's obvious that this is the biggest experiment ever built in physics. So it would be a miracle if it worked exactly right. So when they constructed the Earth, they left machine or most of the Tefitron. Did they run into similar problems?
With the machine? No, I don't think so.
Runway.
The Tevatron had troubles, but not of this kind. The Tevatron for run 2 had problems in getting their magnetic optics right, but it was nothing, let's say, struck. it was a tuning problem.
Nothing blew up. The first run, Tevatron.
Yeah, it took very long time. Run two took very long time. I think it took about 2 years to.
Was the run 1 way under luminosity expectations?
Well,
nothing blew up, but.
So you don't expect, statistically, you can't expect 100%.
Look, let me jump here last night. You're talking about for the experiment or for the machine?
Machine.
I mean, as I showed you, in fact, the machine is off the shelf, let's say, among tools. It's not perfect. See, remember those deviation points. See? But this is what you learn as you go on. I mean, they have all the tools to adjust for this. Issues might come in when you run extensively, so like reliability issues. As we were saying over lunch, I can't really, you know, the CERN beam division, I think, has a fairly strong tradition. I think they have the means to tune the beam for the way they want. You know, the unforeseen is always there and might hit you. I think that this year things are being done with a completely different attitude. There's no mediatic pressure. There is fundamental importance in reliability. So nobody has set the 10th of September date for this year, right? There is no, so it is important that whatever gets delivered to the experiment starting late October is many tens of years to speak about at the very least. So let me jump to the conclusion. If you're interested in this cosmic rays issue, I can talk to you. So this is my conclusion, like this on the state of CMS. What we're doing now, prospect for the experiment. There are some fixes we have to do. We have time, we do them. We would have not done these fixes had we had collision. So these are imperfections you could live with in a real detector. You have time to fix them. We actually have a pre-shower detector installed, basically a silicon truck in front of ECA, basically aiming at gamma by zero separation, which for the gamma-gamma Higgs is a very important component that was not ready last year. So this is what's going to happen starting before, finishing before Easter. So prospects for the year. Okay, I'd like to read what the DG sent out in an email a few days ago. There was a one-week meeting in Chamonix, bringing together the beam division representatives and representatives from all the experiments. This was last week. Basically, the agreed plan follows two fundamental needs. The one need is the experiments need data this year. Scenarios when we do all the installations that we would need to run at 14 TV in terms of monitoring a kit for a machine, which would exclude beam this year, is not common. So the experiments will get this year. Requirement number two is the machine people want to train long enough, want to play with the machine and understand the reliability long enough, 10 TV, so that at the second run, we are ready to go at 14. We do not want to do more than one 10 TV run. The one for this year needs to be the one. So if you put this together, it means that, and if you go through the schedule and the time it takes for the repair, it means that we will start probably late October or early November. The run will be long, so we are talking about 8 to 10 months of operation. There will be only a very short Christmas break, like about 2 weeks, after which we will resume. And the issue of the extra cost for electricity, which is a financial issue, will be addressed and solved. I mean, the DG has budgeted for that. So this is the number which it really tosses around, 200 meters per month. My personal impression is that there is a lot of contingency in this number. So if things go reasonably bad, we should have this. If we're lucky, maybe a little bit more. Not an order of magnitude more, for sure. So the prospect is for this year, with this luminosity, the experiments should be able to run all the basic calibration and alignment programs. We should be able to basically reestablish all the standard model. We should be reaching for many discovery channels, the Higgs included, a sensitivity close to the Tevatron with this. Considering that the very early part of this data will come slowly and maybe you will not be really wanting to use this for analysis. So the very early data, probably there's not much you can do with it. The first 10 or so. So this is the prospect. As I was saying, I'm just finishing. My impression is that the new DG and the unlucky experience of last year has led to a fairly robust plan. So there should be some contingency in this plan. Although I was out of strength the last week, so I haven't really gone through every step. But I imagine this is not a challenge, this is not a success-oriented plan. This is a prudent plan. So I'm confident that we can be this year. Thank you.
Second run, which you want to be at 14 PV, will start when?
So, there's no plan for this. There's no race. The shutdown after the first run will be fairly long. Fairly long means I can't really make an estimate, but I would imagine several months.
So
hopefully less than a year.
So before the end of next year.
No way. Next year, we'll basically be running through almost through the year till, like, you know, the late spring, the late summer, or early fall. 2010, it's 10 TV running almost completely, right? Till the fall. Yeah? Then you stop. You stop and you do all the monitoring upgrades of the dipoles that will allow you to go to 14 TV. This is a long interruption and a lot of cooling the sectors up and then down. So this, how long this will last, I cannot say now. I don't think it's really in plan. But there will be no restart in 2011 in the spring, that's for sure.
Okay, so
hopefully there will be restart in 2011 at all.
So to reach a 14 kV run, you still have to go through a cooling cycle for the whole machine?
You need to go through the refurbishment of all the sectors where you have not installed these monitoring, which I think it's four sectors on the way.
That's at least 4 months.
Yeah, but it's not just cooling up and down. I mean, there's also work to be done. Yeah, at the very least, yeah. What I'm telling you, 2011, we might restart. Not in the first semester. But I don't have a plan for this. I mean, it's not being met. So, you know. But that's the 2011, we might see 14 TV later in the year. We might.
Okay, once you reach the first 14 TV run, that one is going to be how long? Is there a certain amount of time you can run before you have to shut down?
Right. No, this was discussed, actually. So the plan for this machine, I think, is when you run for a while. It's
so
not like that.
You don't get radiation damage on things that you have to stop and do replacements.
The radiation damage that you accumulate is the one for which you have developed the technology, but you don't have to stop. You just, you know, the technology you have has to survive by the design for 10 years. So after the first 3, 4, 5, 6 months. There's no recovery you need to be like. No, there's no radiation. Induced radiation issues are not an issue. The duration of the run, I think, is connected to put it like this. Every run should double the existing luminosity. When you double the existing luminosity, you're able to make a new paper with a significant, you know, impact. So, roughly speaking, it's only later in the program of an accelerator that you run every year giving the same amount of luminosity. So in the same fashion as this year, we run for long, so that at least we match up with the Tevatron discovery and measurement power. Analogously, when we have 14 TV, we want to make a big leap. And this is now, I think that this policy is settled. So how long will the run last? I don't know. 6 months, maybe 10, maybe a year, I can't really say. It's premature. But the schema is not
Not
6 months finished.
Not more than a year, because of the winter shutdowns are.
You know, to be honest, I don't know, because the winter shutdown rule has been broken already. So it just boils down to a changing culture of the lab and some extra money. If you can stay away from the winter, where electricity costs more, you do. But we violate this year, we might want to violate again.
I have a technical question, which probably Mike can answer. If you have 200 inverse picograms and you multiply by the cross section of isolation from 8 going into 2 photons to a pop triangle.
No, you don't
how
have
many inverse do you get per year?
Excuse me?
How many events would you get per year?
With 200 units per command?
It's a back of the envelope calculation. Because you're the one who's doing the electromagnetic calorimeters.
Right.
So you're the one who's going to see the Higgs.
Right.
Because there's no QCT background.
So you have to there is no QCT background. There is no.
Yeah. Okay, so
with 200, I need, I don't tell you the number. What I tell you is with 200 inverse picobar of accumulated luminosity, you have no sensitivity in the gamma channel at all. You need about 9 to 10 femtobots. So in these units, you need about 9,000. This is the number where you do an estimate of you simulate your backgrounds, you simulate your signal, you run the statistics to have 5 sigma signatures of a peak over a big, background dominated fault. So, and also you want 14 TV, right? Because the cross section goes up significantly. So would you stay at 10 TV, you would need even more than 9 femtobots. You would need significantly
the
more.
The total number of events is not relevant.
So when can you get to 9,000, 10,000? That's the $64,000 question.
So to reach that, you need to go to 14 TV, assume that the machine will operate properly, consider that in a perfect year, at 10 to the 33 instantaneous luminosity, which is what you can get with the current LHC design, you would do 10 in a year. So if you run all these numbers, 2011 maybe we start, 2012 maybe there's a chance.
What he's told us, late
2011. Yeah, but conceptual lower limit.
Yeah. At best, 2011.
But we have to be very realistic. The uncertainty of these predictions make this prediction only somewhat interesting. Because there are so many unknowns in the game, right? How well the experiment will perform, how well the machine will perform, how effectively, you run for 10 months, but how much lifetime do you have? Do you run? Do you have collisions 5 hours a day, 10 hours a day, 24 hours a day? These are all big factors that you cannot really predict. You push, of course. You hope that in lab you get a 90% efficiency. So that if you run 10 days, you have 9 days of data on this. But this takes a lot of maturity to reach. My answer to the question is I don't say any number. Before 2011, it's kinematically impossible. Kinematically impossible. But there's a lot of interesting things to be done even before. For instance, there's many beyond the standard model signature that can come in even earlier than 10 to 1.
We could even find an early Higgs and gamma.
It's easier to see.
But what is using gamma? Find Higgs and put gamma.
Gamma gamma decay. Yeah.
Top triangle, 2 gamma.
2 top triangle.
Yeah, for instance,
The Higgs calculates the 2 gammas directly.
Yeah, for instance, can you go back to the picture, the section of the CSM section? For instance, let's say that you produce 1 Higgs and it decays into 2 gammas.
Yes.
So, very basic question. So, what would you see? What will it happen here? So what will detect what?
So
just to understand.
The tracking system, the photon is neutral.
Cool.
The electromagnetic calorimeter, everything.
So okay. It's basically for that. So okay.
Yeah, it's for all the field channel, but
right.
Now of course, you have the rest of the event which is for against chances. Also you have one big problem, which is photons convert. So you can high energy photons going through matter, through the material of the tracker, give you a plus or minus. So, in that case, the tracker plays again because you want to reconstruct those again anyway. But let's say the simple picture that event is 2 clusters in the EM calendar, in the bottom class.
All right. We're all sorry.
Thank you.
That's super great.
Nice overview.
Quite a story.